Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Part of an extensive wine-focused family known in Bordeaux as Les Lurton du Vin, François Lurton runs a successful global business that has estates in France, Spain, Chile and Argentina, places where he finds it easier to breathe, as he once put it. Our fascinating chat covered everything from cherry trees to different Malbec clones, flying winemaking to the Dakar Rally, natural wines to the differences between Chile and Argentina. Hi, François, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you, Tim.
It's lovely to hear your voice. Where are you? You travel so much. Where are you right now? Bordeaux?
I'm just at the office, but I am about to leave to Spain, to my vineyards in Spain. I'll be back on Wednesday morning to take a flight to Birmingham.
Ah, lucky you. And I'm waiting in South America soon.
South America in June. In June, I have to. For the moment, we are finishing the vinifications. I was there for the last crop, and which has been, by the way, a very interesting, very nice crop this year. We have had in South America good volumes, good quality, and good weather. And I go in June to do the first blendings.
Ah, fantastic. Listen, before we get on to talking about all the places you make wine, because it's fascinating, I just want to talk a little bit about the Lurtons. I think you're fourth generation of the Lurton family, is that right, who's making wine, although your great-grandfather made spirits, right?
Yes, my great-grandfather was a producer of spirits in the middle of the 19th century. And he created a nice distillery, quite important. He started to buy grapes to produce wine to distill. He was also the inventor of the new alambic, a style of alambic on vapor. He has been the first to, so it's probably him who has given to the Lurton this this creativity and this potential to create new things. But the problem, he lost his son at the First World War. And after that, he decided to stop the distillery and to concentrate on vineyards. So he bought different vineyards that he has given to his daughter, who was married with François Lurton, my grandfather, who brought the name Lurton, who brought the name Lurton. And after that, the generation of my father got the distribution of the properties in 56, which was a very bad year, freezing year, where there were some icebergs on the Dordogne. And
yes.
yes, it's true. And so the vineyards got frozen, and they had to replant almost everything. It was as terrible almost as the phylloxera. And my uncle was Lucien was the fastest to replant to make money, and he has helped all the family from Brand Cantonac, the property that he had inheritance, and all the brothers, the three brothers, my father and Dominique and Lucien had 21 children.
Wow.
And the 21 children, I am one of them. We are some of us are already grandparents. So, and all these 21 and the children and grandchildren are in the wine business together today.
Are in wine. I mean, they're sometimes called Les Lurtons du Vin, right? Tell us about your father, André, because André was a very, very forceful personality, wasn't he? He played a big role in establishing Les Entre-deux-Mers as a respected region, and particularly Pessac-Léognan, yeah, with the establishment of Pessac-Léognan. Just tell us a little bit about your dad and what he was like as a person to work with and for, because you worked for him for a while.
But my father was a fighter. He went first thing he went to fight against the Germans during the war, and he kept probably from this experience a mentality of fighter. And so he fight on many things. He has been a syndicalist, a very strong syndicalist at the start to protect the agriculture in general. I remember when with my brothers and sisters we were on the barricade. You know, I don't know how to say that in English. Barricade.
Yeah, barricade. Your dad was a great trade union person in a way. Yeah, he was with the unions. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, well, he was in the unions, and I remember in they had blocked the roads in Castillon-la-Bataille, and there on this Castillon, where I remember we were there, and on the place where they were blocking the roads, like the yellow jacket that they do, but it yeah. was in the 60s, and, and my father was one of the leaders of all these movements. Already, and after that, we my father has been a mayor and a deputy, quite politic for a certain period. And his main fight was also for the denominations, the Entre-deux-Mers. He has helped a lot of to develop Entre-deux-Mers, and his main success was the creation of Pessac Léognan in the. It took him a long time to develop this denomination, and also at the same time he had another fight. It was against the TGV, because the TGV was supposed to go from Libourne to Toulouse and not pass to Bordeaux, and was supposed to cut and make a big line in the middle of the Entre-deux-Mers. So he went against the TGV and he won. He won against the TGV. The TGV cancelled this.
What a guy! Now, tell me, now you studied. You didn't study winemaking, although you obviously know an enormous amount about wine. You were born in the vineyards, really. You studied, I think, business and accountancy, didn't you? Has that been useful for you? Do you think, especially as a businessman, I'd imagine it has been.
No, I mean, myself, at the start, I wanted to be air pilot. But Air France, which was full of pilots coming back from Vietnam and everywhere, they closed the school. So there were no. I decided with my competencies, mathematics that I had already, because I was quite strong in mathematics. I decided to go in a school, in a business school, where I work on the financial side and the accountancy. And with this diploma, has helped me a lot of to manage a company, definitely. But myself being a peasant, because I spent my life in the vineyards, in the country, with a country life. This has given me the knowledge of what is a company, how to make money, how to spend it, and that was a very interesting as an experience. But training, or how to say, all my background was in the vineyards. I spent all my holidays planting vineyards, working in the cellar, doing the harvest.
No, I'm going to say you worked in sales and marketing for your dad, didn't you, from 1984 to 1995, sorry. Did you ever consider staying in the business? Would you have inherited the chateau, do you think, from your dad?
I started to after I had the first experience with Moët Hennessy distribution in Paris as a salesperson, and after that my father asked me to join him to develop the sales of the family properties. And I joined in 84, almost 85, I worked with him 10 years almost. I multiplied the company by five in 10 years. And during that period, my father was fighting against the TGV for the Pessac Léognan, and he wasn't there. So I was almost managing the company. And when he has finished his fight, He wanted to recuperate his position in the company. I told him, no, you can stay president, and myself, now I manage, I know all the tools and everything. So we went on a small fight. So I say, okay, but I leave. And he's there. I left. I sold my house that I had built in Bordeaux, and I put the money in the company that I had with Jacques, created with Jacques a few years ago before, and I started to develop the business where I am today.
And that was what, 1988, I think, wasn't it?
No, 1986. I created the company with Jacques in 1988, but I co-managed this company with Jacques while I was still working with my father. And I left my father in 1995, and I joined Jacques definitely at this period.
Tell us how that business with Jacques, it was called Jacques et François Lurton, how was that business born? How did it arise?
I had a nice agent in the UK who introduced me to Marks & Spencer, who wanted to make their own label wine with the white of Chateau Bonnet, the property, family properties in the Entre-deux-Mer. And I told them, no, we cannot, we don't have enough white wine for your brand, but we can produce, if you want, with my brother in a cooperative on the side, a wine pretty similar to the wines of Chateau Bonnet. And so they have accepted, and it has been our first customer of Flying Winemaking in 1988. And we created our company in 1988. And after that, we have had a lot of different opportunities with Bordeaux Négociant, particularly to produce a lot of whites, thanks to the help of Denis Dubourdieu, also in this period, which was a friend of us. And in 91, we take a booth at Vinexpo, close to our big booth of the family. At this booth came a lot of people from everywhere. And among them, Bina San Pedro in Chile and Nicola Catena in Argentina. And these two have been the main customers we have had for the following years. And the story started in South America in 92 with them. But also we had on a side a lot of customers, mainly Scandinavian monopolies and Canadian monopolies, and also a lot of supermarket in English supermarket. Eh? We were working for Tesco, Sainsbury, and the third, the traditional Tesco and Sainsbury, but another one escaping.
I don't know, Waitrose, something like that was
Waitrose. Waitrose. We were for Waitrose. Tom.
Yeah, but Jacques had worked in Australia, hadn't he, with Petaluma, with Brian Crozer. So he brought knowledge back from there. You had the business side as well. So it was a pretty good match, really, between the two of you, wasn't it?
Yes. But the some of the businesses of the wine, the Flying Winemaker, has came through a friend of Jacques, an Australian friend of Jacques, and also we brought from Australia. I told you once we brought from Australia some vines of Sauvignon Blanc that we reproduced at Chateau Bonnet, in the nursery of Chateau Bonnet. Today there is almost a little bit more than 20 hectares of Sauvignon Blanc planted in Chateau Bonnet with this massal selection of Sauvignon coming from Australia. And it's true that Jacques had created also a company in Australia to sell some dry goods, what we call the cork, the bottles and everything. So we have used also this company a long time to produce wines in Australia. And so we have kept a long time relation with Australia. And after Jacques has created his own vineyard there in Kangaroo Island.
So he still has that vineyard in Australia, doesn't he? As well as running the family properties in Bordeaux now, really. Yep.
Jacques is running the properties in Bordeaux today. Myself, I bought his shares in my company in 2007. And Jacques has kept Australia and some of the wine consulting. But his property in Australia, in Kangaroo Island, got burnt during the big fires four years ago. Yes. So he has kept the vineyards, and now he's doing all the vinification in a winery, but in the McLaren Vale on the continent.
And how did you decide in those days where to make wine when you were running this business for supermarkets? Was it just where they sent you, or did you say, hey, I want to go there?
But mainly they were sending us in places like, for example, in Rueda. We have arrived in Rueda with Jacques because Sainsbury wanted us to make a Spanish Sauvignon Blanc. And so they sent, we looking at the map, the only places where there were enough Sauvignon Blanc for such a big market was Rueda. So we went in Rueda and there we discovered the Verderos that we have developed after that. But at the start, was them who were sending us. But sometimes we were doing a proposal for the Tesco winemaker range that we were doing. We had 11 wines at this period on the shelves. And there were half proposal and half wines they had offered us to do.
I mean, somebody once said that the Lurton brothers have Sauvignon Blanc in their blood. Would that be true, do you think?
Yes, but all these experiences of Sauvignon Blanc, they came through my father. Jacques, as I said before, brought back from Massal selection from Australia, but also my father fight a lot of to reintroduce Sauvignon Blanc in the Entre-deux-Mers, and especially in the Pessac-Léognan. After having obtained the Pessac-Léognan denomination, he pushed all the producers and all the classified growers to go back to the Sauvignon Blanc. And today, most part of the top growth, they produce Sauvignon Blanc and even the Aubryon group. When these were mainly planted in Sémillon or 100% planted in Sémillon, like La Ville in the past, where they have Sauvignon today, property like Chevalier, where a lot of Sémillon and there are mainly Sémillon, a lot of Sémillon, sorry, and are mainly Sauvignon today. And that is due to the work of my father. And also, we develop a lot of properties like Coin-sur-Ton et La Louvière with mainly Sauvignon. And we have been trained on the Sauvignon Blanc and helped by Denis Bourdieu a lot of this variety. We know it particularly. We have produced it also in many countries in the world. And so we know particularly this variety.
And you have a brand, Les Fumées Blanches, which is a huge Sauvignon Blanc brand, isn't it? I mean, do you source it from all over France, don't you? It's a vin de France, isn't it?
But myself, I have been asked by the CIVB, the Comité Interprofessionnel des Vins de Bordeaux, in 2004 and 5, to manage a group of reflection about the future of Bordeaux. So, among these the different propositions we have done, there were one which was take off the vin de table to stop the vin de table and to replace it by vin de France. And so we brought this idea to the French minister who sent us to Brussels. And it is one of the members of my commission from Grand Chais de France who brought this idea to Brussels. And he has obtained the disparition of Vino de Mesa, Vino de Tavola, Vino de vin de table, et for vin de France, vin d'Espagne, Spanish wine and Italian wine. And these wines could have the variety and the vintage, which is not that we could not add on the table wine on the past. And that has given the opportunity for big brands like Les Fumées Blanches to source grapes in different regions and to blend different regions and to give more complexity to the blend. Then when you are limited in one region, you are limited to the quality of the vintage and you are limited to the aromatic expression. But by mixing different origin, you obtain a wine much more complex. And also you can eliminate the risk of the vintage, because if you get a ale on a one place, you don't get it on the other place and everything. So that is very interesting. And so myself for the Sauvignon Fumée Blanche, today I use all the tools that I can use from the Loire to the Languedoc. I get some grapes in Cognac, in the Loire, mainly in the Gascony, in the Gers, and in the Tarn-et-Garonne, and in the Languedoc.
Wow, what a blend!
What a blend.
Listen, but I talked to you a bit more about South America, because you said you went there in 1992 and you went on the same trip to Viña San Pedro in Chile, and you went to with Catena in Mendoza. What were the two countries like in those days? I mean, you know, working, were they both similar to work at in as wine producing countries?
No. As we have started there in relation with these companies, but today we have emancipated of this Viña San Pedro and Catena and created our own companies, our own vineyards. The Argentina is much bigger operation than Chile for me, but the also Chile. Myself, I am producing a middle price to high quality wines, and this sort of wines in Chile are very difficult to sell. It's why my project did not develop so much, because in Chile they are not very proud of their wines. There is very few people paying for quality and paying for expensive bottles, and also they don't drink a lot of it. They drink less than the English in the early 80s, and you were in the 10 liters, if I remember. So
it's a lot more now.
A lot more, voilà. Et so it is the same for the Chileans. The Chileans are not educated so much in wine, and I was expecting them to develop a lot of, like the Australians they have done. Mm-hmm. The Australians at the start they were not drinking a lot of, but with the production of Australian wines they have developed their consumption tremendously, but not the Chileans. But in Argentina, it's another thing. In Argentina, they drink a lot of, they are very proud of their wines. They are like the French. When they don't sell their wines abroad, they drink it.
So do you feel more at home in Argentina, do you say? I don't want you to criticize Chile, because it's a country we both like very much, but do you feel more passionate about Argentina in a way?
No, but Argentina is also a very attaching country, quite a very interesting country also, because there is a tradition of wine production. If you go in a small village like Tupungato, for example, in Valle de Uco, you find easily people who know how to prune, how to do all the works in the vineyards and everything. If you go in Lolol, if you go in Lolol, you are sure to find people to go to work in your vineyard, but nobody knows anything about wine. I think Argentina is a unique country comparable to the old of the new world that you can compare with the old world, because there is a population which has tradition and which is very and the village are concerned during the harvest. You know, like we have the villages concerned us in France, and it's not the case in Chile. Chile is a country where they produce wine like they could produce apples or something else.
Or
they
don't have the same. Or cherries.
Avocado, yeah. Voilà.
Tell me, you bought the business, Jacques' part of the business in 2007. How have you changed the business since he left in 2007 and you just became François on your own?
But us the Bordelais, and we have been educated by my father to be against the organic the older organic process. So I had already move Jacques on the organic in the early 2000. But when I bought Jacques, I really push totally the organic side of my I put Chile in biodynamy, and I develop a biodynamy project in almost all my vineyards. But the only one which is certified biodynamy today is Chile, and the others are not certified biodynamy. But I follow the principle of biodynamy in almost all my vineyards everywhere in the world. They are all organic today and certified.
So that was the biggest change, was it?
That was the main change that I have after Jacques. After that, also I changed many things in the way of doing the wines also, because we have had an evolution also in the taste of the consumers and on the demand in the world. During this we have had like this Jancis Robinson. We have the disparition of Bob Parker has changed totally the landscape of the wine. I must say. Hein? We have had today, there is not the consumers, they don't look for the same type of wines. And also my vineyards have aged a lot of, I have another team, and all that has made that I have changed my way of seeing the things, and I have evaluated on many points.
Mm-hmm. And you're now working, I think I'm right in saying, in the Languedoc-Roussillon, in the south of France, Spain, Chile, and Argentina. Are those? Do you have any estates in outside those regions or not in those countries? Gascony. You have two in Gascony, right?
Two in Gascony, three in the Languedoc, with one in the Roussillon. So five for France, two in Spain, seven in Argentina and Chile, nine.
And how did you choose those places as the focus of the business?
Many of these places have been opportunities, or friendship. When you work in one place, before to work in that place, you have to understand what is this place. The best way is to get a good relation with the ex-owner or with the owner himself, and to understand perfectly the place. And myself, in every places where I have been, is because there is a human relation before, somebody who brought me somewhere. And the unique place that we have chosen by, I must say, strategy a little bit is the one in Argentina. And we were looking for a special type of soil. And my father also, that we brought there, wanted us to find a soil with a lot of stones. He wanted gravels, you know, because he was from the grave, so he wanted gravels. And he felt in love with Argentina, my father.
So he loved Chacayes, did he?
He loves Chacayes and the place where we are, saying that is you should buy everything there. But
you bought 100 hectares, didn't you, in 1996?
We bought 200 hectares in Chacayes and 100 hectares in Luján de Cuyo. I planted 100 hectares on both sides. With the sanitary control that we have now in Argentina between the north and the south, I could not bring back the grapes from the north to the south. So I sold my vineyards in Laurent de Cuyo, and I planted 50 hectares more in the property in Chacayes. So I have 150 hectares in Chacayes today.
And there were no vineyards there, were there, in that point?
Mm-hmm. No, but when there I started, no it was... No, it was a desert because the Valle de Uco, which looks like a rugby balloon, only the two points at the north and at the south were planted. The Tupungato side and on the Consulta, where there were a lot of old vineyards. But in the middle, nothing. It was a desert which was belonging to one person only, which had 20,000 hectares. 20,000 hectares. So and we were the first. Oui. And we were the Monsieur Morales, Monsieur Morales, and I could let you meet him next time I go. Next time you go, he's a very interesting person. And it's him who were owning almost all Chacayes,
Most of the Uco Valley.
All the middle range of the Uco Valley, the Los Chacayes denomination.
And what made it possible planting in there was the arrival of drip irrigation, wasn't it, really, from Israel?
Yes. We have in this area quite enough rain. We can have in Bordeaux we have 900 millimeters per year about, and there in this part of Mendoza we can have between 300 and 500. So we can grow grapes there without irrigation. But some years it can be very dry, and so it's better to have the irrigation and also because it's very drainy soil. But also we were very scared of the frost, the spring frost. And hopefully we find some neighbor who had some cherry trees who told us that the cherry trees never got frozen. And that has helped us a lot of to take our decision to establish there.
Interesting. And tell us about how you guys did so much for Malbec. You guys both believed, you and Jacques, believed in Malbec almost before anybody else. And you were some of the pioneers of Malbec or the modern Malbec revolution in Argentina.
But when I left with Jacques in 92 to go for the first meeting with the Catena meeting, and I took the encyclopedia from Hugh Johnson. He was speaking of Argentina. There is only one page in a book as big as that. And in this page, he was speaking only of Malbec. I say, but what is this variety? My father ate Malbec. He has pulled out all the vines of Malbec from all the vineyards of the family. And when I told to my father that I was about to replant almost 50 hectares of Malbec, he said, "No, mais, I take off your inheritance if you do that." No, it was a joke, but when we have arrived in Argentina, myself, we met Paul Hobbs. Paul Hobbs, which was working in the cellar of Nicola Catena at the same time.
Californian winemaker, yeah?
Yes. And Paul was told us, but I'm very interested in the Malbec and everything. And Nicola Catena was pushing us only on the Cabernet. Nicola is what we call a gringo in Argentina because he's coming from the United States. And Nicola was pushing on Cabernet Sauvignon, both of us. Us, we push him on the Merlot, on the Malbec a lot of. But I think the one who definitely let him take the decision on the Malbec is Michel Roland. Michel Roland has been the guy who coming from the north, because Michel arrived earlier than us in 88 in Salta. And he brought he pushed on the Malbec a lot of himself also. And that has been the start of the Malbec in 96, 97. They started really to get interested in Malbec and to make the Malbec what it is today.
And you've also planted Côte, which is sort of a French clone, isn't it, really, of Malbec, probably from Cahors. Do you see a big difference between the two?
Us and also the Clos de Lociété and all the newcomers of the Valle de Uco, we planted a lot of Côte. We planted a lot of Malbec coming from France because we wanted to see if the true clone of Malbec was more interesting, because the problem of the old vines of Malbec is what we call the vegetal material. It's difficult to know where it was coming, where the wood was coming, and if there were no virus inside and everything.
Yeah.
So by bringing vines direct from France, straight from a wine producer, we knew that they were perfect. And finally, it has been a good thing, because the Côte and the Malbec were pretty similar. They are very complementary. If you look at their leaves, they are pretty similar. It's quite difficult walking in the vineyards to make the difference between Côte and Malbec. The only difference is in the berries. The berries are a little bit bigger on the Côte than they are on the Argentinian Malbec. So the Côte is reputed to be a more bigger producer. It is true also than the Malbec, but if you reduce the yield and you make it as big as the Malbec, you obtain wines which are very interesting, probably sometimes more interesting than the Malbec, and very aromatic. The Malbec is a very nice and structured variety in the mouth, but rarely very aromatic. The one we bring these aromas more are the Côte. For me.
It's cut. Yeah, I've came across a quote by you recently, which I like a lot. You said, "There are no limits in life, just your imagination." You like innovating, don't you? I think, you know, every time I see you, you've come up with a new wine. You know, you've done a lot of work with things like natural wines with no sulfites, with orange wines using amphoras. And I think you mentioned earlier that the Lurtons have always been great innovators, inventors in a way. Do you enjoy doing that? Is that a bit of the business that really inspires you?
No, it's true. I think that you cannot a company stagnate if you don't create new things all the time. And also, if you want to have a team motivated and everything, you must have always a new frontier, to offer them. That is important. And also myself, as you said before, I'm not an enologist, so all these securities, the enologies they have with the sulfur, the sulfur is a net of the enologist. You know, they put sulfur, they put their own yeast and everything to be sure that the wine is made. They are safe. The wine is made. Mm-hmm. And so myself, I have fighted always on my company where I have more enologists than commercial people. But against this security that they have around the sulfur, I wanted them, let's make the nature make the things naturally, do their things. So it obliged all my team to be quite innovative, to find solution to face their problems. Problems instead of putting sulfur immediately, I like to create all these things to see where we go. It's a very Lurton this innovation, this Lurton innovation, we should say, more than Lurton Sauvignon.
to push boundaries in a way, yeah?
Push boundaries, yes. But as I said, my fathers, my uncles, my grandfather, their great-grandfather, they were creators of many new machine techniques. My father had a surname when he was young. They call it Clermolet. Clermolet is how to say, I don't know if you, how to say that in English, is the clay you use is the what key. You use to a key is that you use to repair all the engines and everything. He was always creating things. He's a mechanic,
like a spanner or something like that. He was a mechanic. Now, talking about mechanics, I mean, you're a bit of a daredevil, right? You said you wanted to be a pilot. You've crossed the Andes on a horse, and you did the Dakar Rally, didn't you, in the north of Argentina? What was that like?
The Dakar Rally was an experience tremendous. I did not expect to find so much sand in South America. Because when I was younger, I had already crossed the Sahara with the Dakar already in the early 80s. So I never stop this relation with the Dakar, following the Dakar regularly. When I learned that they were coming in South America, I look at the map, I say, they will pass very close to the bodega. So I have to do something. So I participated the first year as a sponsor in a team. And the following year, I took the direction. I took one of the cars of the team and to do this.
I finished it.
It has been tough because I broke a vertebrae. Jumping a dune too fast in Fiambala. Fiambala is a sort of a Tenere desert, in the middle of at the foothills of the Andes, dunes of sand, incredible. But that has been an adventure incredible. Very tough. That has given me, you were saying pushing the boundaries there. Really, I have I thought myself all my life as when I will be 50, it will be the end of my life. I'll be too old. But I've done the Dakar at 50. I said, if I am still able to do that at 50, I still have a long time to live.
Well, I love it. I think the fact that the Lurtons have always pushed boundaries, you're still pushing boundaries. Listen, François, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you for sharing so many fascinating insights into your world of wine and this incredible business that you've created. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for all these good questions. Bye-bye.
Well, the Lurtons are quite a clan, aren't they? And I love all François' stories about his father's impact on the world of wine. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Katharina Prum from Weingut Prum in Germany. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles, and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @timatkin and on Instagram @timatkinmw. See you next week.